this week in the markets. Gold gained along with crude oil, which touched a four-year high on supply disruption concerns. Welcome back, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczak. It's just great to be back with you on this August 5th, Season 13, Episode 664 edition, with another two big guest interviews. Black Gold, Texas Tea, stole the show this week on expectations of U.S. sanctions on Iran and the potential for related supply issues. Investors sold U.S. shares, fearing a slowdown in economic output. But are these fears founded? Well, my first guest, Michael Pinto, says, see, compadres, his 20-point econometric multivariate model indicates we could see the ultimate top in U.S. shares before the end of the year. And gold, the perfect go-to asset at discounted prices. Michael Pinto, president, founder of Pinto Portfolio Strategies. He's looking for $2,000 gold, perhaps a double from these levels before folks even recognize what's happened. And keep an eye on the XAU and the HUI. The precious metal shares could present the best opportunity to leverage those gains. Then Bill Murphy, our friend from Gotta.org, we discussed the headline report that gold miners just found a $15 million mother load gold nugget in Western Australia. Sure put that little town on the map. He thinks we could see even bigger gains in silver, where you can purchase about 80 or more silver ounces for each 1 ounce of gold, making silver the ultimate valuation. And a quick note on our friends at Merck Investments. They're hosting a neat investment symposium and a run/walk on the weekend of October 20th at the Morgan Creek Capital Management, West Barbie Chapel Road, Chapel Hill. At 12:30, that's the reception with opening marks following by Axel Merck and Mark. And then on Saturday, it's the big race day if you're so inclined. You don't have to race if you don't want to, and you don't have to contribute, but they're encouraging folks. There's no fee for the discussion, and it's a good cause in the search for cures for cancer. We're still struggling here in North Carolina and South Carolina, especially near the coast, where tens of thousands are still without power, despite Herculean efforts of Duke Power folks and many others in the rescue area. If you'd like to help out, people and animals really need your help. As a Red Cross volunteer, you can sign up, watch their required videos. They'll send a link to you, and it's easy to do right online. And the Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900, mailbox number 514049. We'd like to field your questions and comments. Just plug it right in, if you like, to your mobile or your phone. Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Mostly sunny skies appeared over the precious metals sector this week on the heels of an explosive rally in the commodity sector. At Friday's closing bell, the yellow metal was up about $10, finishing at $12.05. Silver was off near break-even at $14.65, and the XAU precious metals shares gave back about 4% at $66. But black gold, higher by more than a dollar, at one point hitting $77.50 in West Texas Intermediate Oil Contract, a four-year high, as investors braced for supply shocks following news of Iran's sanctions. That's OPEC's third largest producer, expected to take effect next month on the 4th. Palladium dropped just 15 at 1,057, and Bitcoin suffered, down 64 cents, the ETF that is, at 730. I'm issuing a collapse warning if BTC closes below 5,700. Meanwhile, the top story moving the precious metal sector, black gold, flew to that four-year high on the supply shock issues stemming from sanctions. However, prices subsided considerably by Friday on reports that Saudi Arabia and Russia would fill the supply void by increasing output to at least partially compensate for expected disruptions from Iran. Washington is trying to push Iranian policymakers to the bargaining table to renegotiate if Tehran, they're concerned on nuclear enrichment program. Oil ravenous India benefits the most from the sanctions, receiving 9 million discounted barrels from Iran. The world's third biggest oil importer is certainly happy for that. So the net decline in global oil output was really only about 1 million barrels. Meanwhile, the deepest pockets around global central banks added nearly 200 metric tons of gold to their stockpiles so far this year, a gain of about 8% from last year's 180 tons around this time last year, the best showing in 3 years. That according to the World Gold Council. It's a little surprise then that this week marked a key merger in the gold mining industry. Randgold, ticker G-O-L-D, a favorite of our Alpha Stocks now, so hat tip to all of you, my subscribers at the Alpha Stocks newsletter. We've been heavy on gold for as long as I can remember. And then the merger was with Barrick Gold, ticker ABX. So G-O-L-D and ABX becoming one, an $18 billion behemoth. According to one media source, mergers of this scale near market bottoms are fantastic indications of much better times ahead. This could be just what the market needs to send prices higher. According to one expert, a once-in-a-generation buying opportunity. Bottom line, precious metals. The stunning rally in crude oil helped push the commodities index higher, putting additional support under the metals. The only potential stumbling block I can see on the horizon or in the tea leaves is the strong dollar, which posted another big week and is clinging stubbornly below resistance. With China wrapping up a big holiday late next week, hopefully a fresh wave of buying pressure will re-enter the market amid this traditionally positive holiday season just around the corner. That could encourage the bulls. Moving on to Wall Street, partly cloudy weather appeared over the New York Stock Exchange as U.S. equities concluded a three-month-long winning streak on those oil supply concerns. The 30-stock Dow Jones finished near break-even at 26,447. The S&P 500, though, was off just 28 at 28.85, while the NASDAQ fell 258, by far the most, 3% at 77.88. Meanwhile, according to the Labor Department, companies added 134,000 new non-farm jobs to the payroll last month. That was about 20% lower than analyst expectations at MarketWatch.com. However, the national unemployment rate dropped to the lowest since I was born 49 years ago, the Paleolithic era. Wage growth slowed over the past 12 months to 2.8%, down from 2.9%, but it's expected to pick up on stronger economic conditions. Interesting stocks in the news, topping Zacks strong buy list, Archer Daniels Midland Company, ticker ADM, very strong technical position, and that's, of course, a good sign given the sell-off this week of relative strength. The company procures, transports, stores, processes, agricultural commodities, products, and ingredients, and onto New Park Resources, also somewhat strong, ticker NR, supplies products, rentals, primarily to oil and gas exploration and production industry leaders. And lastly, Principal Financial Group, a financial company, PFG in the Midwest, was up 2% for the week. It's a solid looking company in the charts. U.S. shares bottom line. Clearly concerns of that oil shock and the potential disruption to our economic miracle was tough on the markets, especially the NASDAQ, which topped 8,133 on August 30th, which was essentially priced for perfection. However, the 7-indicator greed to fear index pendulum remains now in the fearful column, but higher highs are still possible in the coming months. More gold seek after the break. It's a pleasure to welcome back Bill Murphy, chairman of the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, working with Chris Powell on behalf of all global precious metals investors. Welcome back.
Good to hear from you.
Good to have you. And you know, the markets have been under some pressure, but the theme this week on Gold Seek from top analysts, including yourself, peak pessimism. It can't stay this bad forever. This is what happens before folks realize they've tossed it out with the bathwater.
Well, I think you're exactly right. And the sentiment is terrible. And what I've noticed is past few days and week, and I think it's a big deal, actually, is that the volatility in all markets is really starting to pick up big time. We've got the interest rates going up, the yield of the 10-year going to 3.2%. You've already had this surge in the oil market. You've got the dollar going up and down. NASDAQ has been doing the same yo-yo thing at 8,000. And pitiful silver has finally woken up in terms of volatility. They are attacking it almost every other day. It's so noticeable, but It's trading, it's coming back against it. Silver's been dead for so long and still going nowhere because of the J.P. Morgan crowd, but it's volatile. And I think the combination of all these things is telling us that we have some big things coming.
That's really the theme that Michael Pinto, he's coming to similar conclusions from a completely different angle. He says that we're already in a slow motion train wreck. It's just that virtually no one has recognized it. And he sees U.S. equities are going to do something that even the top money managers don't expect. They're going to be topping out in the next few months if they haven't already. There will really only be one go-to sector, and that's commodities. And within the commodities, he is a huge gold fan. Here's a little bit of levity. I think the listeners will enjoy an article from Daily Dispatches on Gata. A miner's just found a 90-kilogram precious metal nugget worth $15 million in just 4 days of work. It's going to completely make this Western Australian town probably look like a gold fever, gold rush days. So keeping that in mind, that's what we think could be coming. We think there really could be a gold rush. And Pinto agrees with you that this one will be unprecedented. Unlike 2001 to 2011, where we saw about a 12-year bull market, never a down year in 12 years for gold, this might not take 12 years. This might take 12 months or less for things to catapult higher, and they may never turn back.
Well, that's exactly my thoughts, and I think that's what we have coming. The suppression of gold and silver has been off the charts. I think it's going to end, and when it does end, the gold cartel, as I call them, and you're going to see gold and silver move up in breathtaking fashion, especially silver, because it's so cheap to gold and the cheapest asset in the world. And they're petrified of losing control of silver for that reason.
What do you think's going to happen? They're not going to have $2,000, $5,000, $10,000 for an ounce of gold. They're going to turn to the everyday person's gold. 80 silver dollars, you know, for the price of one gold coin? Once in a lifetime opportunity.
The once-in-a-lifetime deal is it, and I think that the move up in silver was going to be somewhat the way the Bitcoin moved in 2017. I mean, nothing may ever again be like that, but this is what's coming in silver, and it's going to blow people away because we just don't think it's the physical silver's there, and when it goes, there's going to be a scramble to get it because unlike gold, people who the industry who uses silver have to have it. It doesn't matter what the price is, whether it's $14 an ounce or $50, you got to have it for your making. So I think once the scramble is on for silver, it's going to be breathtaking. That's going to be the leader in the sense of explosive price.
There are a lot of interesting similarities, or at least parallels, between silver today and Bitcoin circa early 2017. We had a 20-fold rise. I was right there. Maybe I was lucky, but I saw the uptrend at around 900. And I started telling my subscribers and the whole show, you know, Bitcoin's at 900, it's at 1,000, and as long as this trend's up, we're going to ride it, folks. Was I expecting a 20-fold move in 12 months? No. We give silver dollars to everybody in the family. It is tangible. You can hold it in your hand. You can exchange it. Silver dimes. You can tell their friends about it. And then they go tell their friends about it. And they give a few little silver dimes and quarters and half dollars to everybody. You know, that I just collected by picking through the local bank. I'd ask the tellers, hey, can I have a couple of 50-cent rolls? And you find four each time you go to the bank. And then you distribute them to your friends. Poor man's gold is going to become the new gold. I'm not predicting one-to-one gold to silver. But would it surprise me if in the next 5 or 10 years it didn't happen? No. Palladium is on track now. And this, I remember when it was $100, $200. It's on track to $1,000, and it's headed straight to the price of gold. Why can't AG?
Well, that's a good point. You know what? Even if it goes up half as much as Bitcoin at 10 times, you're talking about $140, $150 silver price. If you go back historically, what it was able to do in 1980, I know that was somewhat of a fluke with the hunts and so on, but it got there, doesn't matter how, 39 years ago. So something to triple in price where it was 39 years ago.
It's making the assumption that gold stays around $1,300, $1,400. But if it goes anywhere near where we think it is, let's just say most conservative estimate $2,500, and you put a 10-to-1 gold to silver ratio on top of that, I mean, it doesn't take a math PhD, $250 silver. And again, a lot of our guests here, some pretty sharp folks. I mean, we're talking billionaires and folks who are like yourself. They've carved out their niche in the markets, calling for $10,000 at the low end on gold, putting silver at $1,000, just if market forces remain tame and under control and non-manipulated and everything's orderly and there are no force majeures or defaults on the LBMA, COMEX, or on the Shanghai exchanges, Perth Mint. While it's easy to receive a lot of these physical metals via the amazing distribution and delivery system we have today that we didn't have, as you say, 39 years ago, the problem is there are fewer and fewer big distributors, there's a whole lot more interested parties by a factor of 10 or 20 fold, and at last check about 10 times more money sloshing around the world if you don't include notional derivatives. Just, it's so opaque, it's almost impossible to decipher. According to the latest source here by Ronan Manley, they're trading at least 130 times more paper contracts of gold on the London Exchange, the LBMA, than they have in their vault, which he claims is the largest Ponzi scheme since way before Ponzi was ever born. Right now, the markets are trading 11 times more gold than has ever been mined in the existence of mankind. How does that not fall apart?
Well, that's a good example of what God has been talking about for 20 years and how the manipulation of the gold and silver markets, what it's gone to and what it's taken to keep the prices down and how out of control it is. And Ronan's a very smart guy, and this is what's going to lead to the blow-up that we just talked about. When this thing, when the S hits the fan and they lose control, and all of a sudden it just isn't going to be there, and there's a good amount of spec shorts now in both precious metals, and when they try to cover, I think you got to scramble. I think it's the key for short term is 12, 15 gold and $15 silver. If they've been stopping it on every advance towards that level, if they fail, look out above.
The metals are so suppressed. I mean, it's lower than whale excrement. It's about as low as it can possibly get. And as you say, when the guano hits the oscillating device, it's all over. And just another little, you know, mental illustration, if folks will indulge me just briefly. In the same article, they go on to point out, while there's so little gold in people's vaults, the real trick here is rehypothecation, which is just financial vernacular for unallocated gold. It ain't there. I think that those days are numbered.
But God has been saying forever that a lot of their central bank gold is gone because it's been used to secretly suppress the gold price. That's how they've done it. And they just kind of, that's when they're going to hit the wall and they won't be able to do it anymore. I've been talking about an end game for a while now, and I'm hoping this is it, this is just the last straw of this nonsense.
I know that you've talked recently about the Exchange Stabilization Fund. This is something that Michael Pinto has also watched closely, and many of our other guests. This Exchange Stabilization Fund, some people refer to it as a plunge protection team, or that might be just an offshoot of it, involves the Bank of International Settlements, the Federal Reserve, and of course the U.S. Treasury.
Three letters, RIG, rig, secretly, and do what they want to do. And that's what they've done. And the plunge protection team got in, I think it was 1987 when they really came into the fore of entering the markets. But they've been in the stock market now on dips this past year or two, three, and make sure that it never fully corrects. Every time it looks like you're going to get a good correction, all of a sudden it's right back up again, make new highs. And, of course, the reverse is true in gold and silver. They've been all over it. And this is what I'm hoping is going to change. And the evidence is, as I've already mentioned, is through this increased volatility in these markets. And that's where they can lose control when all of a sudden these markets get out of control from a rigging standpoint. And we're getting closer and closer. And it could, you know, everything could change next week or we're months away. We just don't know. Nobody does.
Bill Murphy, Gotta.org, as well as La Metropole Cafe, we'd like to hear how we can certainly sign up to receive, you know, a subscription to La Metropole Cafe.
Well, for La Metropole Cafe, you can sign up for a 2-week free trial. Our Gotta with my colleague Chris Bell does a fantastic job. Just got back a while ago from Europe to spread the word. You can go to www.gotta.org and get on his list.
Very good. Bill Murphy, we appreciate your thoughts. Okay, great to be back with you for another GoldSeek.com radio gold nugget. Today's featured guest, Michael Pinto of Pinto Portfolio Strategies. It's just great to welcome back Michael Pinto from Pinto Portfolio Strategies to the show, president and founder of the firm. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on the program, Chris.
Yeah, great to have you back. A topic I've seen in a lot of your interviews lately, risk in 2019 of a global slowdown, and that could have big implications for markets that have really priced in perfection.
Okay, so Chris, the slowdown is already here. The slowdown in 2019 for Wall Street is a low probability. But if you look at what's happening right now in October of 2018, the slowdown is here. If you look at the chaos in emerging markets, you have a slowdown in Turkey and in Argentina and in Brazil and in Europe. And it all stems from the slowdown that's happening right now in China. And I can go on and on. I can name about 19, 20 countries off the top of my head that they are in some stage of a currency crisis, an equity market debacle.
Peripheral nations, we're seeing this. What's going to bring it home to us, though?
We already see that the cost of lumber prices have tumbled about 20% so far, actually about 40% so far this year. Copper is in a bear market. You'll see about 5 or 10 things off the top of my head that's going to bring the chaos in emerging markets home to the United States. So first of all, we know that the Fed has raised rates again for the 8th time since it began this tightening cycle. They're going to raise rates one more time in 2018 in December, and that is most likely going to invert the yield curve. So I know people are going to say, well, you know, look around the world at all that chaos. Look at China. Look what's going on in South America. Look what's going around in Europe. And you say, well, that's their problem. That's not the problem of the United States. But how is it possible that we can invert the yield curve in December of 2018 and not have a recession here in the United States? The last 9 out of the last 10 times the yield curve has inverted since in the 1950s, we have had a recession. Not only this, but the Fed, in my opinion, is probably one of the most hawkish Federal Reserves we have ever had. If you add the 8 rate hikes we've already had 4 times per year, that's the current pace. They're supposed to go 3 more times in 2019. When you add to those rate hiking cycles, 25 basis points at each meeting, when you add to that quantitative tightening, which this very month increased to $50 billion worth of bond sales. So we're selling the Fed's balance sheet down at the pace of $600 billion a year plus 4 rate hikes. Now, I think every time the Fed, every month, when they drain $50 billion worth of liquidity from the system, that's the equivalent of another rate hike. Very, very hawkish Federal Reserve.
Yes, we're watching the balance sheet at the St. Louis Fed. It's a 5% decline roughly from the ultimate peak. However, the recent guidance at last week's FOMC meeting, it sounds a little more dovish, at least on paper.
The Fed said that they are going to raise rates to around 3%. Look at their dot plot. They're going to take the Fed funds rate to 3%. It's only 2.25 right now, 2 to 2.25. And they said they're going to be above that so-called R star, which is the neutral real rate of a Fed funds policy. It's a fantasy that this rate even exists, Chris. It's only in the minds of a central banker that they can pin a real Fed funds rate that's neither stimulative to inflation but reaches maximum employment. Their R star is around 3%. They said in their last meeting that they want to be over R star for 2 years. So let's just say they go to 3.4 or 3.5% on the Fed funds rate, and they want to leave it there for 2 years. Now that, I think, is very restrictive at the same time that they are draining $600 billion worth of bonds from the banking system. They're taking these excess reserves and they're burning them. So you add those two things together and you say, you have to ask yourself, Chris, who is going to support our $1 trillion per annum deficits that are already here?
You know, the typical money manager, they didn't sit through the 2000 crash. Some of them, not even the 2008. And they're thinking to themselves, when I translate this Fed speak, that sounds like a red hot economy. The Fed slamming the brakes on this thing.
So that's what they did in the year two, leading up to the year 2000. They were slamming on the brakes. If you remember that the Fed had the Fed funds rate at 1% between 2003 and 2004, then they raised rates 0.25% at each and every meeting till they reached 5.25% in 2005. And they did so, you know, the Fed wasn't saying, I think there's a housing bubble and I am going to try to pop it. And the Fed wasn't saying that the economy is slowing down and I don't care. I'm going to still jam on the brake pedal, cause the entire global financial market to melt down. They weren't saying that. They were saying, let's gradually pop a housing bubble and let the air out very gently on the seams, on the margin. And then the economy will just slow down, and who cares if the subprime mortgage market blows up, because it's a very small part of housing, and new home construction is a very small part of the global economy. That's exactly, in the U.S. economy, that's exactly what they were saying in 2005 and 2006, and even 2007, until we had those Bear Stearns hedge funds blow up, and they were kind of tiptoeing around the edges even when Lehman blew up. In 2008, 10-year anniversary was last month. So the central bankers aren't proactive in nature. They're not oracles. They don't foresee what's coming. But if you look at markets, markets are telling you, and they were telling you in 2006 and 2007, if you look at high yield LIBOR spreads, if you look at what's going on in the banking system, if you were looking about what's going on, even the stock market was started to roll over in the summer of 2007. So I look at markets. I run money for a living. So I have 20 economic and inflation indicators. So I have an inflation, deflation, and economic cycle model that I monitor and look at for when it's time for me to go net short the market. And believe me when I tell you that I'm not going to get short too early on a net short basis. But when my model tells me it's time to short this market, you have a chance to make a tremendous amount of money, because the value of assets in relation to the underlying economy has never been greater. So the value of assets, if you look at the market cap of equities, they are 150% of the underlying economy. And I can name you a plethora of other metrics, market price to sales, market price to book value. So all these values are at record highs, median PE ratios, record highs. And they are signaling to me that this market is extremely overvalued. It's become completely reliant on central bank quantitative easing on a global basis, which, by the way, happens to end in December of this year. They're going to go from 2017 that reached its peak at $180 billion worth of QE per month, and that goes to zero by the end of this year.
Obviously, the Fed is turning around. They're not just tightening. They're going negative. This is negative territory for the first time since 2008, 2009, the Great Recession. It's a big sea change event here we're looking at financially. And another interesting point you make here in your research is that China, well, not quite twice, our national debt.
Well, they went from $1 trillion in debt, the equivalent of $1 trillion of debt just prior to the year 2000, to $30 trillion. This is not national debt. This is a total debt. So total debt in the United States is $65 trillion. So, you know, we still have a lot more debt here in the United States. Chinese government, when they have a command and control economy, they started to accumulate debt in the year 2000 after the recession that we had here in the United States. And then in the wake of the financial crisis circa 2008, they started really expeditiously piling on debt. Now they have $30 trillion worth of debt. And when you increase debt from $1 trillion to $30 trillion in the span of 20 years, I can assure you that this is the most unstable pile of debt that the world has ever seen. And it wasn't debt that was taken on through normal channels. In other words, it wasn't a surplus of savings that fostered low interest rates that encouraged the public sector to borrow debt. This is all government-infused command and control debt. And that is why it's completely unstable, completely unproductive. And that is one of the main reasons, not just tariffs, that is one of the main reasons why you see so much chaos in emerging markets. It's because of this trenchant and watershed slowdown in Chinese GDP growth.
Okay, but if we look at your peak liquidity chart, I mean, clearly liquidity did peak, you know, somewhere around March of 2017, and we've had at least initially a slow decline in overall liquidity worldwide, and now it's accelerating. But the U.S. is not reflecting that. It is part of that due to the fact that funds have been flowing in here seeking higher returns and the relative return they can receive on the U.S. dollar?
Well, you're exactly correct. So if you have quantitative easing, quantitative easing here ended in 2015, but then started right back up, 2014, excuse me, and then started right back up in China and the Bank of England and in the ECB and most definitely in the Bank of Japan. The QE ending in the United States was almost immediately supplanted by overseas markets. But that's all coming to an end here. You know, just this month, the Fed went to $50 billion per month from $40 billion a month in reverse QE. But also, the European Central Bank cut their quantitative easing program from 30 billion euros to 15 billion euros in October. And they will be completely out of QE come December. So on a net basis, the globe will be shrinking its balance sheet. That's the first time that has ever happened. But let me give you something this is why it's so crucial that I put that in the research. Why is quantitative easing so important, Chris, that we went from $180 billion a month just last year on top of tax reform and repatriation? Why is it so important that this year it goes to zero? So let's take a look at the Fed's balance sheet. Since 2008, the Fed's balance sheet increased by $3.7 trillion. It went up to $4.5 trillion. It's since backed off because of quantitative tightening to $4.2 trillion. Okay, so we have a much bigger Fed balance sheet, an increase of $3.7 trillion at its peak. But publicly traded debt in the United States has skyrocketed to $11 trillion, skyrocketed by $11 trillion to over $15 trillion. So you have this increase of the Fed's balance sheet, which went to 3.7, and now it's just 3.4, trying to support $11 trillion worth of additional publicly traded debt. That is why it's so crucial that when you have a trillion-dollar deficit and interest rates on the debt is soaring, you know, by the way, the deficits in the United States are up 33% year on year. Where is the money going to come from to support these debt and deficits? It has to come from the private sector, and that's money that's being taken away from capital goods creation. And that means the economy is going to slow even faster than normal.
Okay, now let me play the advocate here for Martin Armstrong, one of our guests from last week on the show. He has been one of the permabulls on our show, and he's been right for a decade. Louis Navalier, another. All your facts are correct. However, it hasn't mattered up until this point. Where's the tipping point here? Because I'm looking at your charts, it's very compelling. But again, you know, the road is strewn with the carcasses of the bears for a decade.
Okay, first of all, I manage money. I have a model. It's a 20-point model that measures and maps the growth and inflation dynamic. So right now, the portfolio is not net short, and it hasn't been since the inception of my firm. The process that I'm looking at, one of the things that I mentioned to you before, was let's look at what's new. What do I see happening in 2019? I will tell you, as I sit here talking to you, in October of 2018, that I think the portfolio is going to go net short sometime between now and the end of the year for the first time in order to capitalize from this toboggan ride that I see in stock prices. But why have I waited so long, and what's going to be different? So like I said, the Fed is probably going to invert the yield curve for the first time since 2006. Now, that has never happened between 2006 and till this interview. So it hasn't yet happened during that big bull market that you're referring to. But it's about to happen. The spread is now 25 basis points between the 10-year note and the 2-year note. One or two more rate hikes should be enough to completely invert the yield curve. And that usually, in the past, 90% of the time, precipitates a downturn in the stock market and then a recession about 6 months to a year and a half later. Look at what's going on in 2017 and 2018 compared to what's going to happen in 2019. Okay, the earnings per share next year. So right now we have about 25% year-over-year earnings growth. It's going to plummet down to the low single digits at best. And that's due to the spike in interest rates across the globe. You know, I told you, you know, on the show already that global central banks were printing $180 billion per month of QE in aggregate. But 14 out of the 20 biggest central banks in the world are in the process of raising rates right now. That's new. So we've went from a very dovish monetary policy regime to one that's concurrently hawkish across the globe. Look at peak margins, oil prices that are rising, wages that are rising, tariffs, the chaos in emerging markets, the slowdown in China, corporate buybacks, which were from the Repatriation Act of foreign earnings in the tax cut package. That goes away. These are all things that are going to go away in 2019.
In the year 2000, it was the tech wreck that essentially pricked the bubble. And then 2007, 2008, it was financial / subprime debacle. What are we looking at this? What's the Lehman? What's the Bear Stearns here?
Besides the fact, we are in the biggest sovereign debt bubble in the history of planet Earth. So here's my evidence. Why in the world would any individual entity other than the Bank of Japan buy a Japanese government bond that's duration is 10 years and get 0.10% interest rate per year when they have an inflation target that's 2%, and it's a country that has a 250% debt to GDP? Japan shows you that we are in an unprecedented sovereign debt bubble where some $8 trillion worth of sovereign debt. So the question is, you have to ask yourself, is what's going to happen to that bubble? And as interest rates surge, by definition, if a bubble bursts in the sovereign debt market, sovereign bond prices will plunge and those interest rates will rise. If that happens, and it happens on top of an economy that is taken on a global basis, an additional $70 trillion in new debt since 2007, that's a 40% increase. So we now have $250 trillion of global debt, up 40%, up $70 trillion. So much for that deleveraging that everybody likes to talk about. Even as a percentage of the phony economy, which was bolstered by these low rates, negative rates, it's now 320% of GDP, global GDP, up from 270% in 2008. Okay, so when you have $70 trillion worth of new debt piled onto an economy that couldn't handle that debt in 2008, when you have a bursting of the sovereign debt bubble, which has already begun. So if you look at the United States, if you look at LIBOR, the London Interbank Offered Rate, that was 0.3% in 2006. It's now 2.4%. It's a huge increase in LIBOR, which is tied to $370 trillion in derivatives and loans. If you look at the 10-year note, it was 1.3%, and now it's 3.1% on the U.S. 10-year note. So you have the bubble in sovereign debt already bursting. I just laid out to you how deficits are exploding in the United States without any help from quantitative easing. So as central banks pull back, you're having this explosion in debt, in particular in LIBOR, which is the interest rate that you should be watching if you're looking at the cost of credit cards, any kind of floating rate debt, housing loan, floating rate mortgage loans. So the sovereign debt bubble is exploding on top of the additional $70 trillion in debt. And if you think that's a great environment to buy stocks that are at a record bubble price, then go ahead and do it. I know you're taking the other side. This is not personal, but I am not going to, in an unhedged portfolio, go levered long Amazon and FANG stocks in that environment. It's an extremely dangerous, perilous environment. You're fighting global central banks, and it's not going to end well.
Okay, so then once we see the end of this, see another 2008-style pullback in U.S. equities, those funds are going to flow somewhere. They're not going to be terribly intrigued by the bond market or the debt market. Commodities look like a possible go-to place.
Yes, absolutely. And cash are going to be king, in my opinion. Once we have this another iteration, the next iteration of a global bond crisis. And in particular, precious metals. You know, I like commodities in general during inflation times, but more specifically, I do like gold in the next environment. Gold is set up perfectly if you look at the record shorts on the CFTC. If you look at the universal pessimism, not true. I think gold stands to be in a position to skyrocket in the wake of the next economic crisis.
Okay, so we've heard this, though, for a few years. What's your target on the yellow metal? Let's say after a U.S. equities rollover.
First of all, I have virtually no position now in the gold market, thankfully. My portfolio has been had been short emerging markets and long the U.S. dollar. I have virtually no position in gold as we speak, about a 2% position in the portfolio in a gold-related investment. The reason why I have not been long gold is because my model, which I built, took decades for me to build this model, told me very clearly that a rising dollar and a rising real interest rate environment is not good for gold. However, I don't think we're very far away from starting to see some very negative news on the economic data front here in the United States. And when that happens, I think the U.S. dollar begins to roll over, even against the euro and the yen, possibly on the margins. But most importantly, and here's the key, Chris, I think in the next 2 quarters, so by the end of Q1 2019, the central bank of the United States will move from a very hawkish monetary policy stance to one that is neutral, and then quickly followed on the heels of that to a dovish policy. And then at that time, I think gold begins to rip higher and quickly ascends within 12 months to an all-time nominal high, above 1900 and even 2000.
You know, obviously we've got an unbelievable gold-to-silver ratio. Will we start to see that reverse, you know, because we might lose some of that industrial demand for AG?
You'll lose a lot of industrial demand for AG, not so much in AU. So I don't expect that ratio to close. No, I'm much more bullish on gold.
Okay, but now let's talk about shares, because a lot of our listeners are big fans of the XEU and HUI. Clearly, we've been in the doldrums.
Well, doldrums would be the polite way of putting it. I think that to get leverage on the yellow metal, to get leverage on AU, you need to seek the miners. So in a bear market, gold miners get killed. And in a bull market, gold miners soar hundreds of percentage points. So my intention is to increase the exposure in gold in the portfolio, in physical gold, but to even a greater extent, purchase more of the miners to get that leverage of the gold in the ground once we enter a bull market. And my best guess at this juncture is sometime around Q1 2000.
I'd like to move on to the Case-Shiller Housing Index. We've just seen, especially when you look at it city by city, unbelievable explosion, called an echo bubble, exceeding the former peak in most of the major U.S. cities, Canada doing well.
So the nucleus of the bubble in 2008, the Great Recession, was the housing market. And that is not the nucleus of the bubble today. So if you look at the peak of home prices in 2006, they were 5.3 to 1 on the home price to income ratio, which is one of the main reasons why I was warning about a housing bubble, started warning about one in late 2005. I said, watch this home price to income ratio. It's usually 3. It skyrocketed all the way to 5.3, and I knew that was, you know, unsustainable. And you look at the quality of the loans and all that stuff. On top of it, we are now at 4.7 on a home price to income ratio. So not where we were in 2005, 2006 at the peak, but pretty darn close. But again, that is not the nucleus of the bubble, although there is an echo bubble in the housing market. The nucleus of this bubble is sovereign debt and all fixed income. And in particular, I want to point you to corporate debt. So corporate debt is at an all-time nominal high. Corporate debt has doubled in the United States since 2008. And not only that, corporate debt as a percentage of GDP is at its all-time record high, a little bit above 45% of the underlying economy. On top of all of that, the quality of the corporate debt is the lowest in history. In fact, about two-thirds of it is either junk or one notch above junk. And when you add to that leverage loans, which are placed in collateralized loan obligations, which are owned by the shadow banking system in a big way, this is the bubble. So it's going to be junk bonds and leverage loans and CLOs. That'll be the first thing to start to blow. I think that happens in the next quarter or so. And that'll be the time that you want to go net short in the portfolio and start going longer of gold.
You know, you've teased us a bit with your econometric model. You have a multivariate model you've put together with, you know, interest rates, a lot of macro and some micro variables. Can you give those of us with a statistical background or pension an idea of what you have without giving away too much proprietary?
Well, like I said, it's a 20-point model. There's 10 components of the model that are geared towards divining where we are on the inflation front, and 10 components on the economic cycle model, see if we're growing or if we're slowing. It's a rate of change diffusion index that spits out a number that lets me know where we are on the inflation deflation cycle and growth cycle. The model sits today, we're at sector 2, which is a pension towards deflation, a proclivity towards deflation. I think we head to sector 1, which is a 2008 sort of deflation where you see the U.S. dollar spiking and when it's a good time to short the broader market. So it's a diffusion index, 20 components. I look at things like high yield spreads, LIBOR spreads, real interest rates from the Federal Reserve, pending home sales, auto sales. I don't want to give away the whole model, but there's 20 components very rigorously back-tested. If you want to really protect your investments from the coming decline and to know where to invest, where you're going to get the best return, the safest return, in my opinion, you have to know where the economy is on that spectrum between inflation, deflation, and growth. And if you know that, I think your investments will be treated most prudently.
One slight proviso or caveat. I'm sure you're also somewhat of a fan, or at least acquainted with much of Nassim Taleb's work. And if you read, you know, through his Fooled by Randomness and all his latest stuff, I mean, the one thing he just pounds the table on, beware of these econometric models, because he says you get beyond one variable. Once you pass that threshold, forecasting ability over time, back tested, sure, it's great. Forward tested, it looks good. But in reality, it can blow up.
What model that you can point to has rigorously been tested against quantitative tightening? There is none, because nobody really knows. Certainly nobody at the Federal Reserve. No economic geek out there, no mathematician, and not even a philosopher can tell you exactly what's going to occur when the Federal Reserve takes money from the banking system and destroys it to the tune of $50 billion a month. So the banks were holders of assets. Those assets were taken from them, purchased from them by the Federal Reserve, and the banks held on to something known as excess reserves parked at the Federal Reserve. But those excess reserves were generating interest, and they actually held on to assets that were formerly owned by the banking system that were under distress. But as you start draining $600 billion worth of treasuries from the system, those treasuries, the Federal Reserve owns a treasury. That treasury was purchased from the banking system, from the primary dealers. Now the Federal Reserve says to the Treasury, I have $600 billion worth. It's not $600 billion. It's less than that because there's mortgage-backed securities in there too. But I have $400 billion worth of treasuries in 2019, fiscal 19, which started October. I have $400 billion worth of treasuries that I am not going to roll over. So the Treasury has to pay the Federal Reserve. But the Treasury has no money. So the Treasury now, instead of selling bonds to the Fed, now has to sell bonds to the public. And that raises interest rates. That raises the cost of borrowing, curtails corporations from borrowing money to buy back their shares. It drains the public sector of capital that can be allocated more efficiently. So bond yields are going to spike. That's on top of the $1 trillion-plus deficits that are already built in due to demographics and the interest on the debt. And God forbid we have a recession, which I predict, where interest rates are going to spike and deficits go up by $1.4 trillion in addition to the over $1 trillion that they're already reporting. So that's the process. So whereas before banks were selling bonds to the Federal Reserve and going out and buying more because they had the reserves, it wasn't going into inflation. It was going into asset prices. That's all going into reverse. So if the argument from Mr. Armstrong is that QE wasn't beneficial for the stock prices and bond prices, it's ridiculous. Because I just proved that there's $11 trillion, or at the peak was $11 trillion, or maybe even more. Now it's about $8 trillion of negative yielding debt. Are we saying that the public wants to give money to a sovereign nation and get less, get no interest, and actually pay to loan money to the government? No. It's all about central bankers. And that's going into reverse. And that's why I believe and predict we're headed for a deflationary recession / depression in 2000.
Okay, yeah, you make a good point there. But what do you say, though, quickly to the folks on the other side of the spectrum who are convinced that it had little to do with QE operations, big growth here in U.S. equities, the buyback scenario, that it was record buybacks that really encouraged the U.S. equities investors to jump on that train, and it's been a self-fulfilling prophecy. Go ahead.
It's all part of it, Chris. So corporations took out a record amount of debt.
They distributed their bonds and they bought their shares with it.
Why they were able to buy back their shares? Because the cost of capital was virtually zero. It was very low. But that's not the case anymore. So the cost of capital is surging and has already surged and will continue to surge. At the same time, the Repatriation Act was a one-time shell game where you repatriated foreign earnings, pretty much a one-time event, where you're repatriating foreign earnings and you're buying back shares and issuing dividends. That's all a function of 2018. That's not new in 2019. There is no extra half a trillion dollars coming back into the United States. You have a free trial for the podcast, and then it's a $49.99 per year podcast, which gives all the data that you won't see anywhere else, the analysis you don't get anywhere else. And if you have at least $100,000, I'll actually manage money for you according to that inflation, deflation, and growth model, where you can hopefully preserve your principal, make a little money while you're waiting for the indication to go net short the portfolio. And then I think shorting high yield, shorting the Russell 2000 is going to be a lot of fun.
You're not fully invested, just 2%. You're going to stick with your Q1 2019 thesis that we could see a good buying opportunity in just maybe 6 months or less?
My theory right now, according to the data, is that that's the time frame where we're going to see a change in the economic data. But if the economic data changes, like we have a non-farm payroll report, and if that shows that, I don't think it will, but if there was negative job growth, average hourly earnings fell, then I would adjust my portfolio accordingly. But as the data weakens, and I predict that that's coming, that type of data is coming, ISM data, that's part of the model too. As the data weakens is when I'll start scaling into gold.
Let's talk again after the FOMC meeting scheduled for December. We're going to have that rate hike there. It's virtually baked into the market cake already. I'd like to see if you're... prediction that we might just see an inversion. We have the flattening, but an inversion of the yield curve, because that doesn't bode well for U.S. shares 2019. Thank you, Michael Pinto.
Thank you, Chris.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. The Supreme Court nomination hearings were complete with paid protesters, lawyers that lie, senators who leak, witnesses who recant, media enablers who read their centralized teleprompters instead of actually reporting, paid actors, all of them, trying to create the illusion of organic change and support. But in reality, bad actors, in revealing their transparent hypocrisy. not in how they treated Kavanaugh or his accuser, but how they treated all of us, you and I. As the swamp boils and the certainty of change approaches, an awful stench fills the air, leaving a bitter taste in one's mouth, which all of us have now experienced. Will any of these bad actors be held to account? Will there be any consequences for the blatant disregard of facts, reason, and law that have been made subservient to opinion, innuendo, and confabulation? Or will senators and their enablers simply try and write off this distasteful episode as politics as usual, as we no doubt move into the next news cycle and prepare for a month of sensory assault leading up to midterm elections? You have seen very little good, a lot of bad, and an avalanche of ugly in terms of political and societal changes the past few weeks. Much more is on the way. Remember, change is neither good nor bad. It simply is. You make it one or the other by your choices and by your actions, which is why you absolutely, positively must vote in the midterm elections. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.